Hi, you're listening to a podcast of the best bits of Breakfasters for the week ending Friday the 31st of October. We broadcast live on Triple R 102.7 FM from Melbourne, Wurundjeri Country, Australia. Coming up on this podcast, we interview author Kate Mildenhall, whose new novel The Hiding Place is out now. Justin Digger-Carvalho gets down and dirty with some watermelon planting tips. And Anthony Carew shares some thoughts on begonia. Yorgos Lanthimos' remake of the South Korean film Save the Green Planet.
We delve into rogue renegade sporting leagues and come up with our own Two Legs, One Cup. Vanessa takes us through summer's tech trends with Meta sunglasses, while linguist Kate Burridge eases the confusion around confusables. And Friday Funny Bugger, Bilal Hussain, teaches us his version of the birds and the bees and kissing cousins.
Triple R. Kate Mildenhall is a writer who lives on the outskirts of Narm. Her previous novels include Skylarking, The Mother Fault, The Hummingbird Bird Effect, and children's book To Stir With Love. So cute. She is here today to discuss her latest novel, The Hiding Place, a literary thriller about four families who buy an abandoned mining town for weekend getaways. Kate, welcome to Breakfasters.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Congratulations.
Yes.
Thank you. It's that wild week where it gets out in the world and you start having a real panic about what people are going to think about it.
You're a superstar.
Kate, can you give us a brief rundown of The Hiding Place?
Sure. So like you said, it's a book about four families. I like to think of them as middle class, inner north, progressive types. Who pitch in to buy this property. They're camping families. They want to find somewhere that they can get away for the weekend and put their composting toilet in and get the kids off their screens. And so they go for this three-day weekend to kind of set things up, and things go terribly wrong from the first night and it just unravels from there. And it was awesome. So much fun to write.
Yes. I've got to ask, because, yeah, there's a lot of characters here in the mix and it's told from all different points of view, which is really fun to read. Was this inspired by what was it like writing a book like this, and was it inspired maybe by your own personal experience of a tree change after COVID or something like that?
Yeah, so I've tried very hard. I've said in the dedication that this is not about my camping gang,
yes.
My beloved friends. But I've got
strong
a big,
disclaimer.
Yeah, exactly right. I've got a big gang that we've grown up together. There's about 30 of us who now camp with our kids, kind of multi-generational. There's parents in there as well who come along. And we, you know, every summer it's a kind of nightmare trying to find a place for us all to go. One of the places that we used to camp was really severely impacted by the big bushfires. So we haven't been able to get back there. So we spend a lot of time kind of doing this, one day why don't we just grab a place that we can go and we can set up the tents and the people who've got their caravans can do that and we'll just get away. And one day I found this place. So literally picking up my kids out where I live, out the front of the real estate agent, and there was a sign that said, "Be mayor of your own Schitt's Creek." It was this gorgeous property up for sale for the first time near Walhalla on Gurnai Land. The river, old historic pub there. It was an old mining town. And I was like, we've got to buy this. Like, this is extraordinary.
Mad.
We didn't buy it.
Okay. Because I was going to say,
it was a good premise.
This is going beyond parallels. And this is straight up your life.
We have never hidden a body.
Yeah. But it's this idea, I guess, of like this utopian, like this idea of a utopia, but then kind of things unravel and like, yeah, this tension between this idea of like ideals and morals and and reality.
Yeah, I wanted to really play with this idea of, you know, thinking that you're doing a really great thing. Like, let's buy this property, let's rewild it, let's look after it. But of course, in any group of people, right, you've got people who are looking for a return on their investment or are people who are looking for all these different things. And this idea of the kind of Australian dream, I guess, of land ownership, which is deeply problematic on so many levels, and yet so many people still aspire to that and really want this idea of the idyllic property where you can get away and the kids can be kids again away from the city. So I really wanted to play with that land boundaries. There's squatters there. There's a fence dispute, because don't we all love a fence dispute?
Yeah.
So, yeah, those
I've
kinds
worked
of
in
ideas.
Local council. Don't even get me started.
I like that you threw in there in the setup that they're progressive inner north family. It's a bit of a social satire of how people's politics are often not played out in their actions.
Absolutely. I wanted to call it hypocrisy for a while, but it was that idea too. And you know, when you're doing, well, my theory anyway, when you're doing something that's kind of satire or dark comedy, you take the piss out of yourself first, right?
Yep.
So this is the whole idea. Like, I'm in that middle bracket of I've got teenage kids. I have been in the conversations about whether you're blueberries are organic or what you're going to do about meds for kids, you know, all of those kinds of things. And especially with old mates, I think, that you've grown up with, you all assume that your politics are kind of on par, your ethics, your ambitions are on par. And then you get to a point in your life and, you know, wages are really different and incomes and maybe some of your politics start shifting a bit. And that idea of kind of loving these people who you loved when you were 15, who you still love, but the kind of tensions that come into play.
Yes.
Is wild.
And I love as well the tension between the characters, and you touch on this, of that it's so comforting, this history and old friendships, but also that you get stuck being seen in a certain way and you kind of can't break these roles that you play sometimes or reinvent yourself.
Exactly. We have this, I don't know if you have the same thing with old mates, we have this kind of ongoing joke that we don't really know what each other does.
Yeah.
Because you just assume that you're having the same kind of job in the bottle-o that you had when you were 18 and 19. And that's really grounding. I love that too, because it doesn't matter what high-flying things people are doing now. We are all, you know, you kind of love each other for what you can bring, for the fact that you can get on and cook dinner for the 40 people at camping or make sure you've got your eyes on the kids in the water. So it's all those things coming into play. And I had so much fun, especially with the kid characters as well, bringing them in to kind of shed light and do a bit of truth-telling about the adults as well.
Yes. And look, I don't want to give any spoilers with this book, but, yeah, we start with a body.
There's a body.
Okay.
There's a body.
I got nervous all of a sudden.
You can tell it. There is definitely a body.
It's a thriller. There's twists and turns. What was it like writing that?
So this is so fun. Like, my last novel was kind of set over 250 years, this massive kind of earnest kind of a thing, The Hummingbird Effect. Whereas this time I was like, you know what I want to do? I want 3 days. I want 3 days and I want a body. I want to be in the crime gang. And I just really wanted to play with that. I was watching a lot of TV, you know, they've billed this as kind of the slap meets White Lotus. And that was the kind of fun that I was having with it as well. Like, what does it mean when you have to do reveals and red herrings and try and push your reader through right to the end? And then what I hope is give them a big shock at the end too.
From like a creative perspective, how did you approach that? Was it kind of, did you plot it out or were you surprised by anything
came up? I'm a massive chaotic kind of a writer.
I
start with a premise, and then I reckon I wrote, you know, the body or who, I didn't know who I was going to kill. That was another really problematic part of it.
Very White Lotus.
Yeah, I didn't know who I was going to kill for a while. So I kind of played around with that. And I do a few writers' festivals. So in green rooms for the last year, I've just been kind of bailing up the crime writers.
Yeah.
And doing like, well, how do you do this part? Or where do you work out where the body is? So
I've got a list of names. Pick a name.
Yeah. Exactly. That's what some people do. They're like, you're allowed to kill whoever you want.
Yeah.
Have any of your friends identified with the victim?
Okay, that's a great question. Not with the victim, no. There is a character who I had such fun writing, Phil, who's a bit of a basketball dad. He's got the biggest trailer, the biggest caravan, and his plan for the whole weekend is he's going to cook a lamb spit on Sunday. Yeah. And things go awfully wrong for Phil with the lamb spit, and it was so much fun to write. But, you know, I really didn't like this guy when I was writing him, and I wanted to be mean to him. But by the end, and this is what happens when you're writing books, by the end you kind of identify with everyone and you feel empathic to everyone. And I've had some messages from mates saying, really didn't like Phil, but geez, I get him.
So there isn't a Phil in your friendship group?
There's
then?
No Phil.
Okay. Yeah.
No. I did think about getting t-shirts saying I am not Phil for us to wear camping this summer, but no.
He's definitely stood out to me, Phil, as a character. And there's a few things that I'm like, oh, didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
Oh, look at me just dangling these broad comments to the listeners. And just lastly as well, what was it because obviously it's set in like the Australian bush.
Yeah.
Did that almost feel like an extra character as well, the landscape?
Yeah, I love that. And I went back out to, you know, I visited the property when I was trying to buy it, which I clearly couldn't. And it's just the most stunning kind of place, that big mountain ash forest and the river's pristine. And my parents live out on the Yarra near Christmas Hills. And there's always been this kind of weirdness about the Crown land that's next to the river, even though we kind of go down and swim in it. And, you know, that idea of thinking about what ownership is like with property was really interesting. But also, you know, one of the big features of the book is this crazy kind of wild deer that's in there. And really looking at that, you know, deer are a massive problem at the moment, feral deer, you know, in so many places. So kind of having all of those, it made it feel a bit spooky and wild, but really real kind of issues that are happening at the moment too.
Well, thank you so much, Kate. We've been talking to Kate Mildenhall about her new novel, The Hiding Place, which is out now. Is that right?
It is out now.
Amazing. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks so much for having me.
Triple R. Dirt, dirt, dirt. It's where you grow your plants. Dirt, dirt, dirt. Hey, you got some on your pants.
Can you stop singing about dirt?
I love all of those openers, but that has to be my favourite.
That's Digger singing, though, aren't you?
Yeah. Great voice.
Digger, welcome back to the show.
Morning.
You have been getting into watermelons lately.
Well, it's just that it's that time of year. You start seeing them at the shops and all that kind of stuff. And when I was a kid, it was purely probably just January. It wasn't watermelons all summer long. Mm. And you kind of hang out for it. It was kind of like the first time you see the watermelon is the first time you hear the ice cream truck. Yeah, you just go, oh, yeah, it's on. Yes. It's like it's full summer. It's like I better stop peeling my nose because I've got to go get some watermelon. I thought this year I've had a crack over the years every now and again. I probably, you know, dab in and out, you know, every few years. But I thought, nah, this year I'm going to have a full-on crack. So I'm putting it out there to all, you know, Triple R listeners. Let's have a crack at watermelons and see if we can, like, clock watermelons.
Okay.
Really? All right.
In what sense? Picking the perfect watermelon or growing a watermelon?
Everything we can find out about different varieties, you know, when was the right time. So we all need to keep a diary of what variety we got, what soil we're putting it into, all that kind of stuff. Okay. I want to find out everything about watermelon.
All right. Well, so if someone's totally new to the world of growing watermelons, where's a good place to start?
Okay, first place to start. Surprisingly, what do you reckon their origins are? What part of the world?
Africa.
Yeah, Northeast Africa. Yeah. Oh, tick. Yes. Where's the quiz?
Yeah. Writing that down. I got a point.
Yeah. No one ever scores you any points. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I actually keep my own tally of points. Just for me.
And you're killing them.
Yeah.
You've got every question right this year.
Thank you. Yeah. How do I do it?
Yeah. Northeast Africa. So they're actually quite... They don't mind it arid, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. So this is the whole thing, watermelon, because they are about 90% water by the time they, you know, the fruit ripens. So warm spot is really good, but their sweet spot is like high 20s to low 30s.
High 20s, low 30s.
So, you know, if we get a super hot summer, that can burn them up and dry them out a little bit. But if it's not hot enough and not humid enough, then they don't form. So I would say a good north to northeast orientated position. So you're going to need to get 6 to 8 hours of sunlight at minimum. But at that point in the summer, we can probably get that by 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, you know, and then a bit of shade in the afternoon. So if it does go over the high 30s, it's not, you know, 34 degrees directly on them.
Not getting completely cooked.
Not getting absolutely hammered. So super warm spot. And they're super hungry as well. So well-balanced fertiliser. Chicken manure, worm castings. But the kicker, I've been doing a bit of research and what I haven't done in the past, is a bit of calcium, because they can suffer from this thing called blossom end rot. Tomatoes get it too, and it's a calcium deficiency.
Oh, yes, I think I've attempted this and you can... How do we give them more calcium?
So blood and bones are the easiest.
Okay.
If you're a big egg eater, you could crush down a whole stack of eggs.
Yes, and I put them in the oven, roasted the shells.
Yeah.
Grind them up and then add that to the water.
Yeah, or add it to the soil or to the water, either.
Yeah,
you know, great way to do it.
Stunk out the house.
Oh, it's a shocker.
So be warned.
Yeah, and blood and bone isn't much better. It's very, very stinky. So if you're using blood and bone, you might need to, you know, cordon it off from the dogs of the neighbourhood because they'll come for it. It's like crack for dogs. So, a little dusting of calcium, blood and bone, whatever. But plants it on a mound. It has to be free draining. That's probably the biggest one you've got to remember. They must drain well, mm-hmm. but they still like 90% water. So you've got to create like a big crater for them. So think about, you know, 40 centimetres, 50 centimetres wide by about 200 mil high. With a crater in the middle, and that's where you plant your seed or your seedling into the middle of the crater.
Okay.
So you can deep soak it, and the water will just keep soaking down.
Okay.
And you would be watering probably once a week. So
only once a week?
Only once. Well, once a week, a good deep soak.
Okay.
So you're filling the crater two or three times and let it soak down. It'll absolutely be fine.
How do you define deep soak?
So you've got to think of roughly the volume of water that you're, the volume of soil that you're soaking, and the best way is to fill it up slowly and watch it sink, and fill it up slowly and watch it sink. Probably do that three or four times, and then wait half an hour, and then just go in with the old digits with your finger poked down the soil and see how far three deep soakings gets you, and then you've got a gauge.
I feel like there could be a deep soak meditation.
Oh.
For your watermelon.
You should record one. You should record one. Just digger's footsteps, the keys going on the bench, you unwinding the hose. Yeah,
sorry, excuse me.
I want to hear that in real time.
Yeah. Glug, 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 glug.
Yeah. Fuck. Oh, you're stubbing your toe.
Mate, that would be a long play.
People would listen to that. People would pay a lot of money. Let's get on that.
Yeah. You tell my wife that.
Yeah,
that,
sure. You know,
she laughs about that. So good. Now I'm going to record that.
Please do that.
It makes sense, though. The one time, so I harvested some watermelons once, and I've got to say, I came on the tail end of someone else's hard work.
Mm.
But they were adjacent to, it was kind of on the side of a farm that had a lot of irrigation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So once a week they'd get
a deep soak.
A very deep soak. But getting them straight off the field, absolutely delicious watermelons. Can't really beat a good watermelon, can you?
And that's what I want to put out to the audience. Like, let's all have a crack and have that experience this summer. Mm-hmm. If you get one. What a win that would be, you know, because pollination is a bit tricky. You do get better success if you hand pollinate.
Okay.
So get out there. And so the male flower is quite obvious. It's very phallic. The stamen is very pronounced,
mm-hmm.
whereas the female flower has looked like it's got a little embryonic watermelon at the base of the flower. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the base of the flower, you'll tell a difference.
The like male a strawberry? Flowers,
yeah, like strawberries. Pumpkins do the same thing because they're in the cucurbit family, so they're cousins of pumpkins and cucumbers and squash and zucchini, so they all do the same thing.
So it kind of has a similar vine and flower.
Yeah, it's a ground cover vine. So they'll have tendrils. They can climb if you want them to. Make sure that you get that pollen. So the male flowers will come first. So you could actually pick the male flower off and then just walk around and start inseminating, dabbing it around into the female flowers to ensure you get pollination.
Okay.
You can do it with a little paintbrush or a toothbrush or whatever if you want to be a bit more delicate, but, you know, a bit rough around the edges.
So could I plant a watermelon this weekend?
Ideally, soil temperature needs to be at least 18 degrees. So we're going to get 30 on Saturday, but then it's going to dive back down again.
30 on Saturday?
Yeah, something like that. I reckon prepare the soil now.
Okay.
So plenty of compost and, like I said, your worm castings, your chook poo and your blood and bone.
Mm-hmm.
And then just watch for the temperatures to level out a bit. So once we're into the twos consistently, we just stop dropping down into the twos, that's when I'd say plant.
Okay. All right.
So the twos mean the 20s.
And we've got a fair few questions that have come in. Can I
go through
a few here? Sorry. Trees on the pavement grow up and around the power lines when they get high enough. How does this happen? here we go. Another question.
It annoys me how councils prune around. Like, it's just bad choices. It annoys me.
I've just potted up the tomato plants that grew from my worm castings that I put on other plants. Should I water these every day or let them stress a little? Thanks, Karina.
No, let them go. So the self-seeders are the hardiest. So when you've transplanted, give them a deep soak and then just back off. Like, literally just back off and watch how these things go. So the self-seeders are the strongest.
Yeah, is that because you want to get them to be pulling their own weight a bit? You want them doing the work?
That's right. That's exactly it. Let nature nature.
Yeah. You don't want a helicopter parent.
No, God.
Just let it do its thing. Yeah. Okay, here we go. A watermelon-related question. Victoria, granitic soil? mountaintop cooler climate, which varieties of watermelon?
For a cool climate, I would go Sweet Siberian.
Sweet Siberian summer.
Yeah, so cool. It handles the cooler. So if you're Macedon and, you know, higher altitude areas, absolutely. And it's only a 10-week bearer. So from planting, you'll be harvesting in about 10 weeks.
Okay, yes. So no wonder they need so much water.
Yeah.
10 weeks, that's
so that's fast. For that variety. Some varieties will go out to 14 to 16 weeks, but, yeah. Sweet Siberian.
Oh, then there's just some positive stories. Watermelon stories. Sorry.
Oh, Rachel, just when I hear there's a Sweet Siberian watermelon, does that mean they grow them in Siberia?
No, just cool climate. So my favourite tomato is actually called Siberian. It's the same kind of thing. Anything that's like cool tolerant, they just lean into the Siberia kind of thing.
Because I think Ukraine's a big watermelon grower.
No, well, there you go.
For Europe. There you go.
So many different varieties. Moon in the Stars is kind of everyone's classic one that they start with. You've seen it's like so deep, dark green skin, and then one big yellow dot, and then hundreds of other little yellow dots like star constellations on the skin.
Aww.
Yeah, classic red colour, good flavour, about 14 weeks.
God, they're so beautiful.
And about 10 kilos.
Yeah.
Golden Nugget's a great little one if you want a little yellow. Here we go, controversial.
Okay.
Red pink flesh versus yellow flesh because there's variety. They're called the champagne varieties, and the yellow flesh.
I'd love a bit of yellow.
Yeah, I want to try a yellow one too.
Yeah,
champagne moment.
Yeah,
are they as sweet as the red?
No, they're a little bit on the tartar side. But you know that's a little zingy zing zing. That might be nice.
Can you grow a Waratah in Melbourne?
You can, absolutely, but better in pots because of the soil difference, so like a bit of a free-draining soil.
Hmm. Okay, and some encouragement here. Someone's grown a mass amount of watermelons in their front yard in Oakley.
Tell us your secrets. Who's that?
What are the secrets? Let us know.
Yeah, add on to that. Give us some tips.
And just one last question. So tomato planting yet or soil still cold?
I think it's still a little bit too cool. So ours, I told you the ones with my son, they're still the same size. So I'm holding off.
Because that's the rule of thumb is that cup weekend.
Yeah, traditionally.
But everyone just hold tight a little bit longer.
So if you've got them, keep them in your hot house or, keep them indoors while while it's still a little bit cold. I got a little bit fresh this morning coming in bare legged.
And that's rare, so that speaks volumes.
So hold off. But, yeah, let's get cracking on watermelons this year and we'll all meet back in February and swap stories.
And
munching on some watermelon.
Yeah.
A watermelon party.
Yes, please.
And watch Dirty Dancing.
Awesome. You're listening to Breakfasters. Thanks, Digger.
Pleasure.
Triple R.
Oh, that was spooky.
What a professional ad read.
Yeah. Spookier than ever.
Spookier than ever. Well, speaking of spooky, Anthony Carew, host of International Pop Underground, has joined us to come talk about movies.
Sure, Triple R's spookiest broadcaster is in the house.
Yeah. Probably would be up there, wouldn't you?
Oh, come on, that's Biggsy's title to lose.
Anthony, what film are we talking about this morning?
We are talking about Begonia, which is the 10th film for Yorgos Lanthimos, the Greek filmmaker who's made such bangers as The Favourite and Poor Things, Killing of a Sacred Deer, The Lobster, Alps, many more. It's a little strangely a remake of a 2003 Korean film called Save the Green Planet. It's a pretty radical redo. It is a story of Teddy and Don, a pair of conspiracy theory addled young men living in a rundown rural house in the American South, who kidnap a pharmaceutical CEO and hold her hostage in a basement prison because they believe that she's an alien from Andromeda, a species that have been holding power over humanity through the, quote, techno-enslavement and agri-corporate degradation of Homo sapiens, their environment, and bees, which serve as a leitmotif throughout the film. Their ransom demand is simple, that the alien is to make contact with its Andromedan mothership at an imminent lunar eclipse, where Teddy wishes to negotiate their species withdrawal from planet Earth. The film unfolds and succeeds as a series of negotiations between captive and captor, which serve as an incredible acting showdown between Jesse Plemons, who plays Teddy, the chief conspiracy theorist, and Emma Stone, who plays the CEO, Michelle Filler.
And she's a bit of a muse.
For Yorgos?
Yeah.
This is the fourth straight Yorgos Lanthimos film that she's been in after The Favourite, Poor Things and Kinds of Kindness. Mm-hmm. She's really going for it in this film, like very noticeably has her head shaved. It's visually quite evocative of Carl Theodor Dreyer's classic The Passion of Joan of Arc, which recently screened as part of MIFF with A Life School by Julia Holter. That's sort of like a really seminal person under prejudiced interrogation film that this kind of echoes in some ways. It's much sillier in a lot of ways, but it does have serious thoughts on its mind about the state of the planet and in environmental degradation. You know, I guess it's a film for these times, and it's sort of a portrait of a doomed species on a doomed planet.
This is again one of those films where to me the poster doesn't match the vibe that you're describing. Like, I'd had a look at the poster for Begonia and it looks quite scary.
Yeah.
But what you're describing sounds like kooky comedy. But like it's a dark comedy.
Well, the original film that it's based on, Save the Green Planet, is a really zany slapstick kind of B-movie pastiche. But a lot of its story, like it has a really cluttered story with like a lot of investigating cops. That's completely stripped away. It is still sort of funny, and there's absurdity, of course, in the premise. But it touches on satire without ever fully kind of committing to it.
Yeah.
It's more an interrogation of probably like a post-COVID state of mind. You know, like what young men who spent the pandemic doing their own research might be believing about the state of the world. Obviously, that's been a long-running conspiracy theory. You know, the idea of the lizard people who are secretly pulling the strings behind closed doors.
But certainly not a horror.
Certainly not a horror film. The poster, are you referring to the one where Emma Stone is sort of like gazing up and there's, like, you know, red goo coming down upon her head?
Yes.
It's a visually very striking image. If I really think about it, I'm not sure it has much of anything to do with the film.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, no, I mean, your description has me far more interested than that poster, than that poster does. This also has Alicia Silverstone in it?
Yes.
From Clueless?
Yes. She appeared in a previous Yorgos movie in Killing of a Sacred Deer, I'm going to say. She has a pretty brief turn as seen in flashback as the mother of Jesse Plemons' character, Teddy. There is this time it's personal. The original film played up on that a lot more, the idea of that this person who believes that they're trying to save humanity is really just getting revenge, is really kind of grinding some personal axes. And it's that idea of the sometimes the sullying, the intersection between personal animus and supposed ideology.
And how do you feel in terms of performance with Emma Stone?
Emma Stone and Jesse Plemons are both amazing in this film. They're given a lot of monologues. The script, which is written by a guy called Will Tracy, who, amongst other things, wrote for Succession, is very wordy. It has a lot of love for language. There's a lot of, you know, big words, and they're given these long diatribes and these scenes where it's really just the two of them, you know, in conversation, going head-to-head, sparring. And so they're given a lot to work with as actors, and they're both, you know, live up to it totally.
Yeah. Oh, do you think we're looking at like award nominees here?
No, I think the film's probably a bit too weird. A bit too prickly, maybe. Yeah, there's some real absurdity in there. I don't know if it quite lands exactly what it's trying to do, but it doesn't feel like sometimes you just develop, a sense for these things about like what is and isn't an Oscar film. I suppose that's changing with last year, The Substance, like, you know, Coralie Fasha's body horror movie, which really unexpectedly kind of landed at the Oscars. But this doesn't really feel like a film, not due to worth, because their performances are outstanding, just because it doesn't have that whatever feel-good Oscar campaign vibe.
Yeah. What's prickly about it?
What is prickly? I suppose there's some uncomfortable conversations, which doesn't sound like much.
Yep.
But there's one really key scene in the film. It's at the end of the second act where Teddy decides that to take a different slant to his interrogation of this alien, partly due to something that he's discovered, which I won't mention, but he's like, we're all going to have a nice dinner. Like, you're still held captive. You're still, you know, strapped into a chair, but we're going to have a nice dinner together. But the nice dinner turns really combative, you know, first verbally and then physically, but it really evokes the familiar sensation of like a family sitting down and being like, we're going to have a nice dinner together. And then something political comes up and then people get really tense and then they get really combative.
Okay. Yeah, and I feel like he's such an incredible actor, Jesse Plemons, and he's so good at kind of creating that erratic tension in those characters. You're like, what are they going to do next?
Yeah, yeah, there's lots of that, yeah. He seems very unwashed in this film, you know, intentionally. they're both given so much to do with because the dynamic of their interactions is often changing. Like, who has power? Like, it seems like it's going to be the captor, right? But that's constantly shifting based on how the conversation is unfolding, how they're getting at each other, and the emotions of scenes are constantly changing. That's probably the most interesting part of the film. If you look at it as a sort of theatre piece, you know, showcasing two actors, that's where it's at its most successful. Some of its more absurdist or satirical things didn't quite land as well for me.
I wonder, things like Don't Look Up, is it kind of in that world-saving kind of tilt, but I don't know.
No, I mean, that had a very sincere approach to we're gonna create awareness for climate change by getting a bunch of celebrities to, you know, participate in this very obvious satire about how the world is falling apart and we're all being distracted. This doesn't have as strong a central satirical thesis because it's almost admirable. It doesn't take sides between laughing at either, you know, a spin doctoring CEO who's always trying to negotiate her way out of this, you know, captive situation that she's in, or conspiracy theorists. Like, there are obviously some jokes at the expense of each character, but it never, you know, just wants to belittle either of them. It has quite an affection for its characters, which I think works as drama, but maybe less so as satire.
The other thing is Yorgos Lanthimos has announced he's taking a break after this one.
Oh, I did. I have missed that. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, he's really been
going for it.
He's really been cranking them out over the past, I guess, 15 years. He's had a lot of power and, you know, Poor Things rolled straight into Kinds of Kindness, which probably rolled straight into this. So, I mean, that makes some sense.
Yeah, he essentially has said he just needs a break because he needs a rest. Run out of will and strength. Well, awesome. Thank you so much, Andrew. When does this one come out?
Oh, this film is out today. If you enjoyed my words on such, I wrote about it for this weekend's Saturday paper.
Oh, beautiful. Check that out. Thanks, Anthony.
That's all right.
Independent Melbourne Radio 3RRR.
There was a bit of commotion last week with the news of this new rugby union league that's underground, Rebel Rugby Union League, that will be kicking off next October in 2026, called the R360. I do believe it is.
It sounds like a
fight club.
Well, I think it sounds like the name of a new drug or a weapon, the R360. Anyway.
I'm finding it incredibly amusing, just the use of, like, rogue, underground, illegal, like, R360.
Rebel.
Rebel, and that's it. That was the other one, the Rebel League. So basically an international league that has, like, been, I think, looking to scout a lot of NRL's top players to play, I guess its own season. It's being started by Mike Tindall, or co-founded, who was a former England World Cup winner and player, alongside another high-profile agent, Mark Spores, who and a few other people who also were key in establishing the LIV Golf tournament as well.
Why do they want to do it though? What issue do they have with the current league?
Wants of cash.
Sorry, that was such a dumb question.
It's a lot of cash.
Because they're rebels. They're rebels doing it for wads of cash.
They're saying that it's going to be more of like a better schedule for players. So they're saying that's what it's been born out of, this idea that,
they get paid wads and they can sit on the beach more.
Get paid, yeah. So this is the thing. And so it came out last week that I think New Zealand, Australia, maybe England as well, their national teams have declared that if any of their players go and play in the R360 league, they won't be eligible to play for the national teams. And there's
Fair enough.
I mean, yeah, I guess it just varies. Like there is it's becoming hugely popular. Like there's just so many of these alternate leagues popping up. Most of them are for cash and come from private investment. Like I think money is coming from Saudi Arabia. So it's coming from, you know, questionable sources. There are some leagues though that do it, like for women's basketball, there is a 3-on-3 league that offer, I would say, more money, or it's more financially
viable. Right, because you have to pay less players because three on three.
Yeah, 3-on-3, but it works out better for the players.
Yeah,
so I would say majority is for cash. There are some leagues that are popping up that might present better opportunities for players, probably more in the women's competitions and codes. But, yeah, you got LIV Golf, you got the rugby. There's 3-on-3 women's basketball competition over in the US. I don't know. Then there's even what else is there? There's all the kind of big bash cricket shorter formats that are popping up.
Are they popularity, or are they coming from Cricket Australia still, you know?
I'm not sure about the
probably a bit of both.
Yeah.
The Enhanced Games is another one.
Yeah, getting juice to the gills, as was thrown out there by the swimmer, I forget his name. And look, as someone who my social basketball league got overtaken by a different organisation this year, and they changed a lot of the rules in the game, and they kind of just enforced that we were playing strictly for fun. Now, Rachel.
Oh, yeah.
And
that would not suit you at all, Nat.
It was enforced fun. It really pissed me off. I was like, I'll have fun if I have fun. To the point where we had to give fun points to the other team.
Oh.
And it did. It got me so riled up. I was like, yeah, let's go play on some gravel and just rough this game up even further. So
we want to go play a game that's not fun, specifically.
Yeah. I just don't want fun forced upon me as an adult. I feel like that window closes once you leave primary school.
I wonder if they're enforcing fun at the Enhanced Games or LIV Golf or
maybe just the after party. So there's a part of me that kind of gets it, you know, that there is sometimes a space to.
Is this you pitching on new rebel basketball league?
Yeah, I think it's just called street ball, and I don't think I don't think I'm skilled enough to do that. That's the only shame about that, but I think that already exists. But yeah, just looking at different opportunities, spin-offs for different sports. I know we've got a sporting event. We've got a public holiday coming up next week.
Yeah.
The race that apparently stops the nation.
I don't think that many people are stopping anymore.
No, I don't think so. I think it's a big Nup to the Cup contingent, especially with the Triple R listenership.
Yes.
But I know you've had some ideas for some different races that could potentially.
Well, I don't. Yeah, I'd be keen to get a bit of a litmus test with the Triple R listenership for this one.
Mm.
So, because there are some, you know, when people are starting Renegade leagues.
Renegade, that's it. Rebel Renegade leagues.
Punk rock league.
Yeah.
Punk rock. But some of those, like, you know, they're taking the best bits out of something and using it for something different.
Yeah.
And, you know, I haven't been in touch with the Saudis, so we're not getting any funding for this.
Yeah.
It would have to be proper street.
For the love of the game.
It'd be for the love, probably not even of the game.
No.
Just for the love of the race, maybe. So racing is quite fun. Horses, not so much, but racing's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Melbourne Cup, it's a 2-mile race.
Yeah.
Prince's Park is also 2 miles around.
Okay.
A lot of people go for a run around Prince's Park. Maybe instead of a horse race, we could have a... old school punk rock run around Princes Park. See who wins.
Can we make that's it a awesome. Three-legged race?
Could be three. If you could do three-legged for, 2 miles, that would be incredibly impressive.
That's a long way. Would I'm that actually be too just, long? I'm really struck by how long you're now telling me the track is.
Yeah, it's a big track.
2 miles, so what is that, 3-point-something kilometres?
3.2 kilometres. Beautiful. So, I don't know. Would it, yeah, could you do a run, a human run instead of a horse run?
Mm.
Same distance?
Definitely.
You know, there's probably lots of people that are still really fit from the Melbourne Marathon.
Yep.
Probably a lot of people that are still really fit from the Community Cup.
Yeah, let's ride off. Let's continue to ride the wave.
Do you reckon people could wear, like, coloured Guernseys?
Maybe checkered. That could be part of it. I don't know.
And hobby
have
horse.
Funny names.
Hobby horse competitions have become incredibly popular over maybe the last couple of years, especially in Europe. So those horses on a stick, like the horse heads, the toy heads on a stick. And so people compete rather than like dressage competition.
Okay.
People will perform. So they kind of do the walking of the horse and go through, I mean, I don't know that much about dressage, but they go through.
Over the hedge.
Yeah, over obstacles and all kinds of things. I don't know, walk sideways. So I don't know. I don't want to muddy the waters here, Jay, so I'm just throwing out some ideas.
Yeah, I wonder, because it's a public holiday, maybe there's some things that we can take from it.
Yes.
But not use the, like, I mean, leave the horse bit out of it.
Why don't we just propose people go at 2 p.m. and on next Tuesday run around Princes Park?
Yeah.
Just see how many people show up.
We'll have a big picnic.
Yeah. I think, okay, let's... I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud here, Jason. Please interject
because this is vision.
So, okay, scrap the hobby horse because that's just another thing to acquire and people might not have it. I love your idea, Rachel, of wherever possible, if you have any silks, any colourful clothing.
Little hat?
It's silk's very breathable. You really want to sweat in that. Go for a run. So if you've got a silk shirt, some silk shorts, something like that, just to kind of dress it up a little bit.
Maybe we could do it as like a fundraiser for like Wildlife Victoria or something.
Okay.
Just
that's
really
a great
flip
call.
The script.
Yes.
Just completely hijack this event that's going on.
I love it. The opposite.
We'll get rid of all the bedding, all the yuck stuff and make it like a fun, wholesome.
What's the
opposite? Not enforced fun, of course.
Yeah. We won't. No. Yeah, you don't have some fun to have points. Fun. You don't have to have fun if you don't want
What's the opposite of bedding? We'll just give out cash.
Yeah.
No, we'll have some stacks.
We'll have some, yeah.
We'll have some scroggin or something like that.
Yeah, I'm going to scroggin for coming across the line. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe there's some other ideas of what we could do with the day.
Yeah.
I feel like we've got to hijack it. It's stuck in the calendar.
Yeah.
Well, everyone's got the day off anyway, you know, like it or not. And I do like it.
Or is there something as well that you would want to make competitive? Because I know I discovered there is a extreme ironing competition that I discovered maybe the start of this year where people just take their ironing board and an iron to these extreme locations and iron. And I love that. I mean, ironing I find quite
competitive ironing.
Yeah, therapeutic. So you can make anything competitive.
There's tomato planting is a big thing for Melbourne Cup weekend.
Oh, yes.
Because it's the right time of year to plant your tomatoes.
Yeah. So maybe, I don't know, maybe there's...
This weather is not feeling like tomato planting time, but... Yeah, because that's the rule of thumb, is that you should have 3 days in a row over 25 or cup weekend.
Yeah.
For the Tommies. That's what Digger told me.
Send us some ideas. I reckon we can just really hijack Melbourne Cup Day and do our own thing with it.
Our rogue rebel racing league.
The Saudis are doing a lot of theft. They're stealing a lot of sports, but I reckon we can lift our game and bring it back to the street.
We're taking the public holiday back.
Yeah.
Triple R.
Vanessa De Holker from Bite Into It. Good morning.
Good morning. How are we?
Oh, we're not too bad. How
Excellent.
Are you?
Very well, very well. Today I thought we would look at a device that's tried and failed to go mainstream for years. But now it really might be starting to have its moment. I'm talking about smart glasses. And you might recall Google Glass about a decade ago announced with great fanfare quickly became a punchline because it just looked so geeky and people were concerned about privacy and it cost a fortune and then it broke easily and didn't have great battery life. And you're like, wow, that's quite a list of problems, people. So why talk about this now? Well, the big tech players aren't giving up and I thought it's worth looking at in this moment, particularly coming up to summer, where, you know, you might be thinking about a new sunglasses purchase. Will these qualify? The answer's probably not. but hey, there have been a lot of developments. So smart glasses have often felt like gadgets first and had the utility come second. And they've got these quite poor camera on your face associations. People have concerns about privacy. And wearables in general succeed when they deliver a really clear and consistent benefit. Think about how we've adjusted to fitness trackers and smartwatches and things that help us track sleep and what have you. You know, they really have crept into our lives in addition to our smartphones. So what's changed at the moment? Well, the display technology is getting better, and the ability to combine that with AI, so models behind things, computer-assisted vision, voice assistance, and better display optics. So the glasses have the potential to do more. So they might recognize objects, or they might translate text, or they might overlay info. So you're starting to go, there's some potential to do useful things there. Design-wise, the form factor, you know, the latest models are slimmer and lighter and they look more like normal glasses. And this is partly because lots of companies have decided to partner with people who know how to make cool glasses.
Not just IT, but like big tech companies trying to make cool sunnies.
Let's not design these from scratch. We know how to do glasses. Some people know how to do them anyway.
Because when I hear about these, I just have the sensation of these heavy glasses sliding down my nose.
Yes, yes. Spoken like an occasional glasses wearer.
Yeah,
that's so real. There's that massive collaboration between Ray-Ban and Meta, Xiaomi and TCL are entering the market as well. There's a whole range of things. So there are more useful kind of use cases is what us in product development would call them. They're emerging, and there are hands-free tasks and voice commands and translation and accessibility support. So people are throwing different things at it and trying to see what will stick and what will be helpful for people and what people will, you know, pay for. But there's also the software ecosystem maturing, more developers finding it accessible to write programs for these. We haven't seen a killer app yet, and I know the killer app expression is a very old-fashioned one, but it's still pretty relevant. What is going to cut through and make you switch and say, wow, I can see the value of this investment?
Well, yeah, it feels like it's never really been clear why. What is the purpose of choosing to add this like gadget to your life?
Yeah, so they absolutely need to address that. One of the really interesting ways that people have been doing that is that beyond pure consumer functions, there have been a range of accessibility functions that are very valid. So smart glasses are functioning as hearing aids for some people, and for some low vision users, they're tapped into services where volunteers are describing surroundings. So Meta and Aria Research are both significant companies who have examples of those sorts of accessibility features in their smart glasses. And that's quite exciting for people who have accessibility needs. Xiaomi are also experimenting with things, massive, you know, tech company in China, and they're trying to compete on price and go, we think we can do these things cheaper. Amazon's getting into the action. They've shown off advanced eyeglasses for delivery workers for the first time publicly. It was announced a while ago, but just this week we've seen what they look like.
For delivery workers?
Yeah, so they're known internally as Amelia, and the idea is that they've got a small screen that gives turn-by-turn directions, scans package codes, takes photos for proof of delivery, and is, you know, replacing things like the GPS in the car, but also the, you know, the bulky handheld, you know, package scanning sort of thing. They're trying to wrap it into one form factor.
And do you reckon that will be able to tell if they've taken a pee break?
I can only think about the complications about switching it on and off.
Yes.
You know, and you see that, what would you call them, like sort of police and law enforcement workers in lots of different areas with body-worn cameras have had to navigate those challenges already.
Mm. Yeah, right.
So it can get very complicated very fast.
And my initial thought is as well, it's like that's too much, like, distraction if they're driving.
But I think they're trying to reduce the distraction.
Okay.
It's, the idea is that you're juggling so many devices anyway, this information's coming at you. Can we streamline it?
Yes. That sounds like Amazon.
I get the streamlining part, but I guess it's just being in your eye line, I guess. And then being glasses versus it being on your wrist or something like that.
Yeah, I have no idea how that's going to switch.
Anyway, to muddy the waters.
Vehicles.
Do you know what would be a useful use for these glasses for me? Is glasses that tell you why you entered a room. Like when you walk in a room and you've forgotten why you're there. If
it could just... you've entered Dr. Jen territory here, I've just got to say, because she did a wonderful segment on that mental phenomena as you know, forget something as you literally go through a gateway or a door or a portal of some kind, what your brain interprets as that. Worth going back for. That was gorgeous. But I can't help you with it.
And neither can the glasses at this point.
They really can't. They really can't. So what would the remaining hurdles really be? I mean, we've talked about price. We've talked about battery life and size and weight. We've talked about design and style, and social acceptability is another part of that. Mm. You know, the design helps with the social acceptability, but where there's a big gap is those privacy and social concerns around things filming. Although I think we've moved on that as well. When I thought about the delivery workers and people saying, oh, well, does that mean they're recording all the time? It's like, forget the delivery workers recording. It's all the people with Ring cameras and what have you, you know, other sorts of home cameras recording the delivery workers. This is just an equalization perhaps of that. And also, we've all got smartphones. People are recording things all the time. Perhaps that's just become more normalised, for better or worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are both good and bad uses of this.
Mm.
So maybe the horse has bolted on this.
I would say I think the accessibility, what that brings for that is fantastic. I mean, but the fact that they're glasses, I think sunglasses, and I'm already hesitant, and maybe other people are as well, of like buying an expensive pair of sunglasses. I feel like they'd be up there with one of the most lost items.
Yeah, well, really?
Sunglasses.
Yeah.
But that's maybe that's just more about me than anyone else.
You're probably right.
But, I mean, wouldn't that be terrifying as well? I suppose we walk around with everything on our phone and risk losing it.
Yeah.
But I don't know, sunglasses on the head or something.
Yeah. I wonder maybe that one of the selling points could be, like, if you see – sometimes you might see a Pedro Pascal lookalike. At the, you might see
that
Sandy Roberts.
Yeah. That was very cute.
Yeah, a little photo.
Yeah.
Prove
it. Hey, another gap is in the prescription lens integration.
Okay.
So many people wear glasses for medical reasons.
Yeah.
And they really need sophisticated solutions to weave that in. When you're working with, say, a Ray-Ban, then that's – fairly easy. They've partnered under that same deal, Meta, with Oakley. So we can expect to see Oakleys come out, I believe, this summer, which, you know, is an interesting thing for the Australian market, I would suggest.
Well, I feel like that's real 2000s / Matrix. Maybe it'll be a hit.
I think it will be a hit. I mean, those glasses have been making a comeback.
Mm.
The wraparounds.
Oh, goddamn wraparounds. They're no good for Asian nose bridges, so I really struggle. Anyway, but that's a me problem. We've covered a few me problems for the group. So what could this mean for everyday users? Look, if the promise is fulfilled, you could see tasks made easier. You might walk down the street and get translation of a sign, or have contextual AI assist you in real time, capture an image or video without pulling out your phone, you know, get some hands-free help while cooking or repairing something. You know, it could be the next major wearable. But as I said, the killer app's not here. Is it finally time for smart glasses? Maybe. if you're an early adopter and someone who values hands-free access to info, or someone intrigued by, you know, these sort of wearables, it's an exciting time, but we're waiting for the mass market moment.
Just quickly on you wanting the feature of
Telling me why I entered a room.
Yeah, maybe if you bumped into someone in the street, an acquaintance. Oh. If it's with Meta, maybe it can like cross-reference your Facebook friends.
Recognition.
Give you the name.
I thought that, but I didn't want to say it because that is like doing the face scanning.
Maybe that's the breakthrough feature.
It's yes, you've brought up a brilliant point. It's both fantastic and terrifying.
The privacy issues of scanning people's faces and knowing their names is, I don't want my devices to do that.
Just
help me know why I entered the room. That's it.
Well, thanks for indulging the smart glasses talk today.
Thanks, Vanessa. Vanessa Holger from Bite Into It. Thanks for that chat about smart glasses.
Thanks all. Triple R.
It's just gone 7:45 here on Triple R. We are joined by Professor Kate Burridge, a professor of linguistics at Monash University. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, good. Thank you so much for joining us. So you're here to talk to us about the concept of confusables.
Yes. It's actually a term I learned quite recently. There wasn't actually a label for these words that I have real trouble keeping apart. I don't know about you, but I have a bucket load of words that I just, you know, I was murkily entwined and I've never been able to keep them apart, and it's always a great relief when dictionary editors finally agree and start cross-listing them. So continual would be one, biennial, homogeneous.
God, yeah. What?
Is that a different? What's the difference between those?
Well, our dictionaries have given up on this, so don't worry. Yeah, but I think homogeneous has to do with uniformity due to a common origin, whereas homogeneous is just simply uniform.
Okay.
That's a fine distinction.
The one that always gets me as a journalist writing, I'm like, I'm never sure if I've gotten it right, is the difference between an inquiry and an enquiry.
Ah. Yes, and there are dialectal differences there too, but technically they're the same word. It's the word came in from French, so it should... and it was originally spelt with an E, so that's the French spelling for that word. But then it got this classy Latin look with an I. And so then we had these two spellings, you know, inquiry with an I and enquiry with an E, a bit like ensure and insure. And sometimes when you get different spellings, people start assigning different meanings to the different spellings, thinking, well, there must be a distinction. In effect, with inquiry and enquiry, I mean, it's all pronounced inquiry because we swallow the unless, you know, you say... inquiry, if you put the stress like some American dialects do. So for some people, inquiry with an I is a more formal. I don't know whether you have that sense or...
I often associate inquiry with a government inquiry into an issue, whereas inquiry is like a question that's more informal. So,
Yes, that's right. We had a great debate about what word to use in the title of our school and it was a critical inquiry or critical enquiry. But I think one resulted in an unfortunate acronym. It was CACI, which was probably not ideal. So I think that ensured that we had the E. But, you know, in something like ensure and insure, we have a clear distinction, don't we, between the meanings, even though it's, again, pronounced ensure, because we swallow any vowel that's not stressed. That's the problem of English and has been for some time.
And you've sort of hinted at it a bit there with the enquiry example, and I'm sure this probably does vary from case to case, but do these words have generally similar etymologies? Is that why they sound so similar?
Often they can do. In that case, that was one word, so they go back to the same word, and same with ensure. But in the case of uninterested and disinterested, that's another one. Some people insist on keeping those distinct. They obviously are different words, but when you see they first entered English or appeared in English in the 1600s, and they both shared meanings back then. So people who insist on the distinction say that uninterested means a lack of interest and disinterested means unbiased or impartial or something like that.
Sure, yeah.
But in fact, the first registered meaning for disinterested was showing a lack of interest, and uninterested actually had the meaning of, you know, unbiased.
They've actually swapped over time.
Well, yes, but I think they've never been clearly distinct. And if you think about it, interested has that same ambiguity. So you can talk about, you know, I'm interested in that, fascinates me, or interested parties has that meaning. So I think the distinction has always been artificial, but, you know, try telling people that. They get very fierce about it.
Get into a debate. One that always gets me is effect, effect.
Another one that's because of that reduced vowel, because it's pronounced effect.
Okay. Mm. But is there any difference in the meaning?
There is. If you remember that affect with an A, and I have to stress that, then is the verb. You know,
yes.
My dog's death affected me, mm-hmm. And it has a strong effect
on
me.
Yes.
So that's the noun.
Okay.
There are some places where they can be used as both used as noun and verb, but they're rarer. They're more, I suppose, specialised context. So that's a good rule to remember. If you could, but it's a bit like me in biennial and biennial. I can, you know, I have a colleague who said, "Well, just remember biennial asters." And I'm thinking, I don't know a lot about the life cycle of aster flowers. But, you know, so it doesn't really help. And I have to think, do they flower twice a year, or is it every 2 years I have to replace those asters?
If anything, this has muddied the waters further.
Right. What is the, would the difference be the Biennale is more of a celebration or something? Or?
I have to think about it. It's the ambiguity of bi, because it can mean, you know, occurring twice or every two. So biennial is every 2 years. So a biennial conference, I think, is every 2 years. And biennial is twice a year. But you're far better off saying twice a year and every two years. And that would keep twice alive.
Yeah. It doesn't have the same ring.
No.
Does every language have these?
Oh, I'm sure, yes. But I think in the case of modern English, and, well, it has been for a while, because we have that problem of the reduced vowel, it's such an important vowel, it has its own name, and we might have talked about this before, I don't know, the schwa, which is the unstressed vowel, so that every unstressed syllable, that vowel reduces to basically, effect, complement. See, we don't know whether that's compliment or complement, because that's both... The middle vowel there is reduced to .
So it didn't even occur to me those were different. So compliment as in a collection of things, or compliment as in a nice thing to say.
Oh my God, I didn't even know that's right. Spelling. See, and that's come about because of that vowel, which, you know, has been the heartbeat of English for centuries, and we know that because people, you know, varied the spelling of the vowels in these unstressed syllables and have done so for hundreds of years. But, you know, modern Englishes, where it's spoken by, I think, the so-called native speakers of English are outnumbered 3-1 now, and the most speakers of English as a second language will have a more rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat rhythm where those vowels are given their full pronunciation. So maybe this kind of ambiguity will... some of it will go anyway, but we will always have ones that, you know, sewerage and sewage, and ones that have always been kind of...
Lovely to think of. Yeah.
Early in the morning, yeah, I know. Yeah. I never say sewage, you know.
Where does the stressed vowel, where does that come in? I guess, like, if we're stealing lots of words from, like, English is Germanic, but we stole lots of words from the French, or the French invaded and brought all their words with them... which have lots of accents and umlauts.
All sorts of different stress patterns. You're quite right.
Yes. Yeah.
See, once upon a time it was quite straightforward. English stress was always on the first syllable.
Okay.
And then, like you say, we, you know, sucked up words from everywhere. And in fact, only a quarter of modern English, roughly a quarter, is in fact English. So all of these other words that came in with their own stress patterns. So that we have, something like origin, original, originality, the stress will change in each of the derived forms. Whereas if you stick to a good old English word like neighbour, with a stress on the first syllable, neighbourhood has the same stress on the first syllable, neighbourly has the same stress, you know, so it was straightforward. But and look, we're sorting it out, and that would be a fine topic for, you know, a long discussion about what's happening to English stress.
Wow. Okay, so that's where I guess that's over hundreds of years then.
Yes. So if you change the stress for inquiry and enquiry, you know, inquiry, critical inquiry, then it's fine. You've got that. You can see that vowel, or you can hear it rather.
Is it the same process that you find with, like, individual confusables with, I guess, sentence level confusables, if that makes sense? Like, for example, the way that people will say for all intensive purposes rather than for all intents and purposes. Is it the same kind of brain collection that is kind of going on there?
I think in that case you sort of remodel something to be more familiar, or sometimes it's a matter of, but it can be more intensive purposes. Yes, I suppose, because in normal rapid speech it could sound very similar.
Mm.
That's right. And that can happen with a lot of those reanalyzed phrases.
Mm.
You know, a doggy dog world becomes a dog eat dog world, you know, which is pretty nasty. Dogs don't tend to eat dogs, but, or is it? No, it's a doggy dog world.
No,
isn't
no
it? Think, yes, yeah. It's the other way around. Yeah. Yes, because dogs don't eat dogs, and because a doggy dog world. Yes,
oh, it is a doggy dog world. Oh, I'm not familiar with that one.
It's a good thing it's dropped out, really.
Yeah,
but yeah, that's the confusing. You're quite right. It can come about the same way. Mm.
Do you have a favourite confusable?
I'm not sure I have any favourites. They're all awful.
They're all terrible.
with continuous and continual, I thought I had a, you know, because continuous was supposed to be non-stopping and continual was frequently, I think. So I always remembered it by the trucks that had continually stopping. I thought, yeah, well, they're not going to stop continuously, are they? But then they changed and suddenly, you know, trucks were stopping continuously. And then we had continuous assessment for students. And I assure you, we do not assess them uninterruptedly. We do give them breaks.
Yes.
So, and then I noticed that, dictionaries cross-list them. But I suppose floundering and foundering are kind of fun ones.
Yes, I love. I'm just imagining, I'm like, what kind of texts and emails is Kate sending? Because I was just thinking, I'm like, what is the silver lining of confusables? I can be terrible at replying to texts and emails, and then sometimes I'll just stop mid-text because I'm like, I don't know what the difference is between a while and a while. Like, what's the spelling here?
Oh, yeah. Well, in
so
text,
I'm like, I need
text
to check
it doesn't it. Matter. You're yeah. excused everything. In
the but then I'll just stop. I'll be like, I'll get back to that later, and then I'll never get back to the person. So it's a new excuse now. Sorry, I got stuck on a confusable. I didn't get back to you.
Professor Kate Burridge, thank you so much for joining us. That was so fascinating.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Melbourne's own Triple R.
Friday funny bugger time, and can you believe it? We've got Bilal in the studio. Thanks
for
coming back.
Thank you for having me. Happy Halloween. Thanks.
Happy Halloween.
You happy guys Halloween. Spooky Halloween.
I know, right? You guys can't see it, but these guys are dressed up, and I love the energy. Jason's got his Carlton jersey, and I'm like, oh, he's come as something that shouldn't be in the AFL, but okay. Oh, Charlie Conan, face mask as well. I love it. Bless up to him. I'm a Carlton supporter, so I'm like, even I'm like, I get it, Charlie. You know what I mean? Like, move on to bigger and better things.
Okay, you're more forgiving than Jason.
Take the cash.
Yeah.
Take
oh,
the
really? Cash, yeah, no, take the cash. I said it last time. I'm all about that cash. So let's do it. I think last time I was here, I spoke a lot about, like, being Lebanese, Muslim, and, like, going to Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I might stay on theme if that's cool with you guys.
Yes, please.
Yeah.
But I think rather than location this time, I'm going to talk about language, if that's cool.
Please.
So, like, growing up, spoke multiple languages. Do you guys speak any languages in here?
Maybe two and a half.
Oh, two and a half? What languages do you speak?
English, German, and I'm claiming French.
Oh, claiming French? How good is your French?
I can read and write.
You're like, I can do Duolingo, I've hacked Duolingo and I'm all good.
Yeah.
No, that's cool. Well, do you find that, like, you have gaps in your English as a result?
Yeah, sometimes it flips back the other way.
Interesting.
You use the wrong word. But when you do that with French, you actually just sound like a real posh.
I wish Arabic had that.
Too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I wish Arabic had the same result on people. It does not. But, like, this is the thing, right? Like, and I find I get treated different because, like, I feel really blessed because when I stuff up the English language, I find that people are really nice. They're like, oh my God, you speak multiple languages. How sick.
It's very impressive.
Well, this is the thing. I remember, like, my dad telling me stories because they don't speak English, right? Or, like, have really broken English. So when he came to this country, he'd have to, like, memorize words before going. And, like, he'd, like, walk to Coles, and once he was trying to buy honey but forgot the word for honey and no one helped him. So he's walking around Coles going, buzz, 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 buzz. And they banned him.
Damn it.
Because he kept pinching people in different aisles going, buzz. It's funny because that's the guy who raised me. Like, that's the guy who taught me about the birds and the buzz,
yeah.
You know?
This is easy life.
What's worse, and that's what's funny thing about languages, I've like told people that story and Arabs find it even 10 times funnier because bzz in Arabic actually means titty.
Oh.
So it's just like levels to it, you know?
So on date night, you and your partner head to Coles and just hit the aisle.
We've also been banned.
Yeah.
No, but it really is an interesting thing because I still remember the first time I realized I had gaps in my English.
Mm.
I was at my first ever sleepover. So I was about 27. No, and I still remember this because, like, I realized I didn't know the word for doona or duvet for scum. But anyway.
Yes, well said.
Doona team.
Yes.
No, but I realized I didn't know the word for doona. So I'm, like, looking at my friend being like, bro, can you pass me the sheet, the black one, the one to cover myself? And he was like, do you mean a burqa? And I'm like, oh, this is so bad. And, like, full context, like, he is my widest friend.
Okay.
Like, first fleet wide, okay. Like, that energy. And
yes.
He said that, and he wasn't even joking. He had one on hand to give me.
Oh, what?
And I'm like, why? Like, what is this? And he was like, it's an Islamic garment that Muslim women wear. And I'm like, no, I know what it is.
Yeah. Like, I want to go to bed.
Yeah. And I was like, why do you have this? And he was like, my mum's into role play. And I'm like,
no.
And I'm like, it turns out, like, his mum's going by Maria in the streets, but Sharia in the sheets. And it's crazy.
Oh, wow.
No, it
quite the sleepover.
Well, it kind of like created like this thought process in my head where I was just so like, despite people being nice about it, I was just like in my head about these gaps in my language.
Mm.
So like, and it comes in like the form of like words and phrases. So like, as a result, like, anytime I notice that I've got these gaps, I try and fill them up as quickly as possible. And sometimes I do it wrong. So, like, are you familiar with the phrase maiden name?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it meant the feminized version of my name.
Your maiden name.
That makes sense.
Well, this is the thing. Like, I'd be on forms and I'd see it. And instead of writing Bilal Hussein, I'd write Bella Hussein.
Bella.
And it just made it so awkward. I went to the doctors and the doctor literally was like, oh, the nurse was like, oh, actually, so nice. She was like, oh, it actually means your mum's name. And I'm like, oh, cool. Wadad Hussein. And she's like, no, before she got married. And I was like, this is a weird way to find out my parents are actually cousins. And I'm still rattled by this fact because I didn't know this. No one told me. Like, no one doesn't get discussed. So I'm sitting there going, how do I deal with this information? You know what I mean? Like, and I'm seeing that, and for years I've been calling people racist for calling me, like, assuming that stereotype. And now I'm like, the far right dudes are just right, you know? And I'm like, ah! But
damn it.
To be honest, like, because I've got an analytical brain, I'm like, I've been thinking about it. And because it's still, like, I'm rattled by it, I'm just like, maybe more people's parents should be cousins. I shouldn't have said that out loud.
Yeah.
Because I'm analytical, I found evidence to prove my point.
Okay.
Albert Einstein, mm-hmm. one of the greatest minds to ever live, a genius. Huge brain. His parents were cousins.
No way.
He agreed with it so much he married his own cousin. Okay, one example. Nelson Mandela, freedom fighter, freed South Africa from apartheid, right?
Madiba.
Yeah, so his parents were actually royalty. So cousins with extra steps. And my last and final one, Paul Rudd, Ant-Man.
What?
The guy who brought you I Love You Man, his parents are actually cousins.
No.
Wow.
He's actually coming out with a sequel to I Love You Man called I Love You Cuz. I look it up. Everything I say is truthful. It's facts.
I am looking it up.
Yeah.
Is this...
It'd be so embarrassing if I've been telling people this and it's actually not true.
Second Why cousins? Have you got a list titled Kissing Cousins?
These guys were like, what are you going to talk about today? I'm like, I'm going to keep it light and breezy.
Yeah.
Talk about family, you know?
Dating your family members.
All I'm saying is, like, I'm telling people this, and people are, like, so creeped out when I say it. And I'm just like, I'm just trying to say family should come first. And that's... I'm sorry. I feel like I'm not a normal morning person. I'm just, like, always this. Like,
no.
There's no lubricating in the morning. I'm so sorry. So
why are you dating your cousin?
Unfortunately, I've broke the cycle. I'm not following in the steps of my parents. I think also comedy is also not following the steps of my parents either. No. So I think comedy broke their heart more. But anyway.
And where can have you got any gigs coming up? Where can people see you?
I've just finished doing a bunch of gigs. I opened for Carla Colafella, which was cool. But you guys can follow me on socials at Bilal Snack Pack.
Great.
Yeah, I post that there.
Lots of cousin content.
Lots of cousin. I should not have told that story.
No, it's good.
I want to be known as that guy, the cousin guy.
Yes. Last time you were in, you were plugging a fundraiser.
Yes.
How'd it go?
Yeah, it was a fundraiser for Palestine. And it was amazing. I did it with Freddie Arthur and a few others. Geraldine Hickey was the headliner, and we raised about $3,000. So amazing. Thanks to everyone who came out. Thank you for you guys for letting me promote it on here. You guys are amazing.
Oh, it's been so great to catch up again.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah.
Thanks, Bilal.
Triple R on FM, digital, online, and via the app.
Thanks for listening to a podcast of the Best Bits of Breakfasters, the Monday to Friday breakfast show broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia. Feel free to get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or via the Triple R website.